Weaver on page, what is that?
76, I think.
76, yeah. So we read the last passage again. Therefore, from among the 12 deeds of a Buddha, they consider, they here referring to Bhaskara, consider that the taming of the demons at twilight and the preceding deeds are performed when a common, at a common, what? When a common being, okay, when a common being, and that the three bodhisattva paths of preparation, seeing, meditation are all, are only meditative equipoise. So unlike the hearers, the bodhisattvas and the Pratigya Buddhas, what they do is that, in most cases, what they do is that during the path of accumulation, they are so engrossed in accumulating virtues, and then after accumulating the desired virtues or the merits accumulations, then in a single sitting, which means you just sit on a cushion or wherever, just within that very single sitting, on that very single sitting, they achieve all the rest of the paths in just one, a single continuation, just one continuum without any break, which means a part of preparation, seeing, meditation, all in just one go. So whereas, in the case of the hearers, the Shravakas, they do it the other way around. So while they accumulate merit and wisdom on the part of accumulation, and then in the part of preparation, part of, you know, seeing, part of meditation, they also do the same thing, absorbed into deep meditative state, and again come out of that. So because of which, I told you last time, the path of seeing, they described it as just one, meditative state, pure meditative state. And then the path of meditation can be of both, meditative state and a post-meditative state. Similarly, the path of normal learning. But in the case of the bodhisattvas and Pratigya Buddhas, what they do is that whatever they have to do in terms of accumulating merit and wisdom, they do that during the first part of accumulation. Then the rest of the parts, part of preparation, seeing, and normal learning, they just do that in one sitting, in one continuous meditative state. So now here, look, one which is so distinctive of this school's exposition is, of the 12 deeds, the 12 deeds of the Buddha, the first 9 are asserted to be the deeds of a bodhisattva, and the last 3 are asserted to be the deeds of a Buddha. So last 3, the state of achieving enlightenment. Then after achieving enlightenment, the deed of giving discourses to the sentient beings, two. And the last, passing away into parinirvana. So these three, if you look at it from a very ordinary reading of the Buddha Shakyamuni's biography, we see that these three activities are the activities after him having achieved Buddhahood. Whereas the previous nine activities or the deeds of the Buddha, of course, they were before achieving him having achieved Buddhahood. So which means that the first 9 activities, they are associated with the activities of the bodhisattva, and then the last 3, they are associated with the activities of the Buddha, right? So this is how the Vipassakas and very likely the Suttrantikas as well read it that way, which means that the Buddha Shakyamuni, while he was displaying the first 9 activities or the deeds, he was not a Buddha, right? Okay. Then, I don't know if that is here, it seems like, oh, it's here, yeah, so let's see. And the last 3 are asserted to be the deeds of a Buddha, so up to this point, it's quite clear. So, okay, this I think we need to explain it. And then also look, so what would you, how would you imagine? Say it is a hearer, some, you know, a hearer practitioner. And then finally, so within this life, you know, so say this is last life. And then say he's now, he or she is now in his like, what, 30 or 40 or 50, say 50. So at the age of 50, the person, the hearer practitioner, became arhat at the age of 50, right? So which means, what about his or her, you know, from while he was 1 year old to 49 years old? Was he arhat?
No.
So, after having achieved arhat, so he is already freed from samsara. But what about his body? Came from the parents, you know, from the parents, this life's parents, or is that something newly created after having achieved nirvana? No, from the parents. Which means that, you know, it is contaminated. So last time we discussed about the contamination, contaminated phenomena. So this body, even after having achieved nirvana, their body is what? Contaminated. So before he achieves nirvana, is his body prone to sickness? Yes. So what about him after achieving, after having achieved arahatship? The body, is it prone to sickness?
Yes.
Haven't they eliminated all the karmas that would cause him to be sick?
Good idea. Say, well, yep.
The conditions arise, but the Buddha doesn't experience it.
It is not the Buddha, I'm talking about the arhat.
Oh, the arhat does not experience it as sickness.
But, so let me be neutral in this terms, in this sense, and simply, you know, say for the time being, I'm not going to express my take on this, right? Instead, let me narrate the stories what I've heard. Moggallana, who, as I said earlier, the supreme disciple of the Buddha in terms of miraculous power. What happened was that he and Shiriputra, they went down, you know, through the miraculous power, they went to, both of them are arahats, you know, excellent arahats, right? So among arahats, there are various levels. Just as among professors, there are various levels of, you know, degrees of qualifications and knowledge and these things. For example, say physics. There are, I think, at least some, you know, 1,000 physics professors on this earth. So among them, only like 2, 3, or 5 become, you know, they come out so prominently. Say like Stephen Hawking, like that, and what, Brian Greene, you know, so like this. So otherwise, all these, it doesn't mean that all other, I'm also a physics professor, you know, I should also come out so prominent. So this is not the case. So while having been in the same post as the physics professor, again, within them, there are various, you know, degrees of quality. So similarly, among the arahats, although they are all just equal in terms of being arahats, and because of having eliminated afflictive ignorance, but still, in terms of their, you know, intelligence, in terms of their power to say, some of them can see, you know, 100,000, 20 world systems through their clairvoyant powers, and whereas others can see 100 world systems, and Moggallana, he can see the most, you know, because his miraculous power is considered to be supreme among that of all the students of Buddha Shakyamuni. So what happened was that he, along with Shariputra, both of them went down to hell realm to examine, you know, to see through as to what's really going there. And then they met someone, actually, you know, one of the Hindu masters has taken birth there. And then he was just crying in agony and, you know, pains and these things. And then because of the, formerly they knew each other, the Hindu master and Moggallana and Shiriputra. So then he sent a message to them saying that requesting his students on the earth not to do any kind of, you know, pujas and so forth, because their pujas are something very different, like killing animals and so forth. So pujas, not to do them, because the more they do the puja, the more suffering that he has in hell realm. And then two of them, so innocently, went there, and, you know, Shariputra, because of some task, he went, you know, earlier. And then Mukhalayana was the one who actually went there to pass on the word to the students of the master, saying that, oh, your master is in hell realm, and he wants you not to do the pujas. And they really felt so offended. How can they trust Mukhalayana? Because they belong to two different traditions. So it is as though like deliberately coming to provoke them. And then they started beating me so much, beating Mukhalayana, you know, to the point of almost death. And then Mukhalayana is believed to be the one who has the most excellent miraculous power to fly, and, you know, instantly, or he can simply disappear his body instantly. All this power he has, and yet he was beaten to almost death. And then his body was thrown amongst the bushes. And then, you know, some of the monks, they found his body and then brought him, and then he was given treatment. And then he was, you have such a power of, you know, miracle. Why didn't you display that? And he said, oh, let alone, you know, really displaying it. Even the thought of displaying it didn't come to me. So when it comes to a very strong karma, even if it is arahat, you have to experience the result. So then it is said that Mukhalayana then passed away due to that reason, for that reason, passed away. So he is an arahat. Not only that he is an arahat, but his power of, you know, miraculous feats is just so well known, and yet he had to experience the pain, right? And he's an arahat. So therefore, this is the story. This is what is to be taken as a very authoritative story or legend associated with all these Dharma instructions. So this means that, you know, even the arahats, as long as they have their physical body from the previous, you know, previous karmas propelling, the pain associated with the body is always there. Right? But the issue is the mental pain. So he didn't have the mental pain. He has the physical pain. Right? Okay. So likewise, what about the Buddha? So Buddha, he is believed to have achieved enlightenment at the age of, I think, 29, like that. 29, 30. So what about... And here it says that all the deeds, the first nine deeds, which the Buddha was associated with before him reaching the age of 29, they were all associated with the Bodhisattva's deeds, right? Now the question is, this is quite acceptable, you know, quite acceptable to some extent. We don't know for sure, you know, even that. But still, to some extent, it's quite acceptable. So we say that he achieved enlightenment at the age of 29. Then what about his body after having achieved nirvana? Oh, sorry, Buddhahood. Do you want to explain it exactly the way we try to explain it to the arahats? Even after achieving arahat, the body is something contaminated, which is simply he is carrying the old body. The mind is, you know, something so fresh, something so pure. But his body, the old one, you know, contaminated, because of which he is still prone to sickness, aging, beating, and all these things. Right? So then what about the body of the Buddha after achieving enlightenment? His body, is it the continuation of the body of the Bodhisattva when he was, you know, of the age before 29? Or after a new body? Okay, now look at, let us see how Vipassika explains this. Then next we read, the proponents of the great exposition assert that a wheel of doctrine is necessarily a part of seeing, and that a wheel of doctrine is necessarily a wheel of doctrine of the four truths. So the wheel of doctrine of the or the Buddha's teaching, you know, the wheel of doctrine or the Buddha's teaching. So they say that this can be understood in two ways, in the form of verbal teaching and in the form of spiritual realization. The teaching in the form of spiritual realization and in the form of verbal teachings. So, in the form of verbal teachings, Vaipashikas only accept the teaching the Buddha gave on Four Noble Truths, which means the first turning of the wheel. Vaipashika only accepts the teaching, the first turning of the wheel on the Four Noble Truths as the teaching of the Buddha, the turning of the wheel of the Buddha. Right, and then in terms of the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha Dharma, in the context of spiritual realization, they say that it is only the path of seeing, it is only the path of seeing which understands the Four Noble Truths. So in both cases, you know, whether the teaching in terms of the verbal one or the spiritual realization, it is associated with the Four Noble Truths. The first one is the teaching on Four Noble Truths. And the second one, the realization, is the path of seeing which sees the Four Noble Truths, right? And you may wonder as to why they, you know, stick to this, why they are so, you know, rigid on this. It's because, of course, this is something true, but, you know, we don't know whether to really, you know, see that as something so credible. Say what this, what they say is that when the Buddha Shakyamuni was giving discourses, the first turning of the wheel, the Four Noble Truths, to the five ascetics, the first five human disciples, then the first disciple who realized. Who achieved the path of seeing, as soon as the first disciple achieved the path of seeing through the Buddha giving discourse on Four Noble Truths, from the sky in nowhere, from the sky, there is the thunder-like utterance. Of course, that is believed to the sound of the devas, that, oh, the Buddha has turned the wheel of Dharma. So that really coincided. The, you know, the devas proclaiming that the Buddha has turned the wheel of Dharma, you know, that utterance exactly coincided exactly with the moment the first disciple of the Buddha achieved the path of seeing. So, therefore, it was when the Buddha was giving discourse on Four Noble Truths. So, therefore, the teaching, the Dharma of the wheel, in terms of the verbal teaching, is the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. Because when that utterance was made, you know, the Buddha was giving discourse on Four Noble Truths. And then in terms of spiritual realization, it is only the power of seeing which understands, you know, of Four Noble Truths. Because the first disciple who, you know, during the utterance of that sound from the devas, the first disciple, he experienced the power of seeing, which sees Four Noble Truth. So therefore, in terms of the verbal turning of the wheel, Vaipashika only points to the teaching on Four Noble Truths, and in terms of spiritual realization as the turning of the wheel, they point to the path of seeing which understands the Four Noble Truths. So let's see. The proponents of the Great Exposition assert that a wheel of doctrine, referring to the Dharma, is necessarily a path of seeing, number one, in terms of realization, and that a verbal wheel of doctrine is necessarily a wheel of doctrine of the Four Truths. The proponents of the Great Exposition assert that the seven treatises of manifest knowledge the seven treatises we speak about, you know, about the Abhidharma and all these things. So these are, you know, spoken by the Buddha and written down by four destroyers. I don't know whether written down, but, you know, they are spoken by the Buddha and then compiled. Instead of written down, we say compiled by the four destroyers. Because, you know, At the time of the Buddha, it is believed, a speculation, that there is no system of writing down things. So then it was only later on, it is the third council, during the third council, maybe after about 100 years, maybe, 100 years after the Buddha's assuming parinirvana. So this means that these arahats, they're compiling it. They would compile it because they have the power to memorize. They have the power to retain the teachings of the Buddha in their mind, so fresh, so then they can recite it. During the first council and the second council, it was just reciting what the Buddha said and not written down. So, I don't know. Until written down, we can say compiled by the four destroyers. Four destroyers referring to arahats. They say that Buddha's words is always literal. So this is one thing so unique of Vaibhashika. All teachings of the Buddha should necessarily be literal, meaning that everything, whatever the Buddha said, should be accepted literally. No, don't ask question why. Or this the Buddha intended for something else. So never interpretable, all definitive, according to Vaibhashika. But don't worry about prasangikas. They have all these two, interpretable as well as definitive. The proponents of the Great Exposition assert that the seven treatises of manifest knowledge, or the Abhidharma, manifest knowledge meaning Abhidharma, were spoken by Buddha and written down by four destroyers. They say that Buddha's word is always literal. Apart from the 80,000 bundles of doctrine, they do not assert the presentation of 84,000 bundles of doctrine. So this is quite, interesting thing. It says that usually, whether you talk in terms of the lower schools or the higher schools or Tantra, we always speak about the 84,000 of Buddha's teachings, bundles of Buddha's teachings. And then, at one point, there's also the mention of only 80,000 rather than 84,000, right? 80,000. Now the question is why at one point we say 84,000 and other times we say 80,000. And the story or the legend has it that it was, actually the Buddha taught 84,000, but why 80,000 is, all the teachings, 80,000 constitutes the teachings which the Buddha gave after Ananda became the Buddha's chief attendant. And you may wonder, what is the connection? It's very interesting. So somehow there's a kind of consensus that Ananda should be the chief attendant of the Buddha. And Ananda said quite reluctantly, "Oh, I'll be more than happy to do it, provided the Buddha give teachings only in my presence." And then henceforth, whenever the Buddha gives teachings, he's always there. So all those teachings, the Buddha gave after Ananda became the chief attendant of the Buddha, that constitutes 80,000 bundles, And the rest of the 4,000 bundles were taught before the Ananda having become the chief attendant of the Buddha.
But that also includes the first training of the wheel.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. This is because Vasubandhu's Treasury of Manifest Knowledge says, those 80,000 bundles of doctrine which were spoken by the subduer, and then we read that, the place where bodhisattvas actualize enlightenment during the last lifetime is definitely just the desire realm. So according to, again, Vaibhashika, the Buddha Shakyamuni achieved enlightenment under the Bodhi tree of Bodhgaya, right? So Bodhgaya is sitting in desire realm or form realm or deva realm? Desire realm. So then from their point of view, anyone who is going to achieve Buddhahood should necessarily achieve Buddhahood in desire realm. And therefore, the proponents of the Great Exposition do not assert a presentation of heavenly adorned, highest pure land, or an enjoyment body. What is that? What is that place in Sanskrit? Or actually, in Tibetan, is Homintubukubishingam. This is exactly what it said. A heavily adorned, highest pure land. So this is in English. Sukhavadi, no, Suva, not Sukhavadi. It's fine, it's fine. Omitubhuga Vishingam or Akanishta, I think so.
There are five Arya Pure Lands listed.
What is the last one?
Akanishta is the highest one.
Akanishta.
Omin, not low.
Omin. Oh, yeah, yeah, Omin. Omin. So this, you know, this is one part of it. This one. Evila Rune, highest pure land. Okay, let's say that. Or an enjoyment body. So actually, from the point of view of the higher schools, the state where the place where the Buddha, you know, someone achieves Buddhahood, is either in the state in the heavily adorned highest pure land, beyond, which is higher than the highest, higher realm, or in the form of enjoyment body. But whereas, according to Vipassika, this is not the case, because the Buddha, you know, achieving enlightenment, he did that under the Bodhi tree of Bodhgaya, which is in desire realm. Then, not only this, but they also do not accept omniscience. And then they don't say that Buddha has omniscience. No one has omniscience. You know, omniscience is something which cannot be achieved. Reason why they say so is that omniscience should have the connotation which understands everything that exists simultaneously. But according to Vipassika, this is not possible. A mind will understand an object, just one object at a time. However refined you are, however, you know, enlightened you are, you can only understand one object at a time. Then you may wonder, then what is Buddha? Then why is Buddha so special? It is so special because without any effort, his mind, wherever he wants to, whatever he wants to know, he simply directs it and he knows that. But, you know, the object that he should be knowing is what he cannot know simultaneously, but in sequence. Unlike us, if we want to know emptiness right now, no, it's not coming to us. Quantum mechanics, no. Neuroscience, no. But the Buddha, it's just for him to direct his mind, and direct his mind on this particular object, then he knows that. So this is the specialty of the Buddha. Otherwise, just as our mind understands one object at a time, similarly Buddha's mind as well understands one object at a time. As such, there is no omniscience from Vipassika's point of view. All four destroyers of the three vehicles have nirvana with remainder, because they assert that when one attains a nirvana without remainder, there is a severing of a continuum of consciousness, like the extinction of flame. Okay, so this is quite important. Nirvana, or, you know, achieving the state of final cessation of afflictions. Nirvana. So this nirvana, you know, there are several kinds. Say, the nirvana with residue, with nirvana without residue, you know, and the non-abiding nirvana. Okay, yeah. So nirvana with residue, without residue, and non-abiding nirvana, right? And ashinyang, the natural nirvana. Okay, so natural nirvana means, natural nirvana means the state of the, nirvana has the connotation, something which is, you know, a state which is freed of something. A state which is freed of something. This is what is known as nirvana or liberation. Liberation means something which is liberated from something, right? So this is the connotation. So when we say natural nirvana, it simply points to the ultimate reality, emptiness. Why emptiness is referred to as the natural nirvana? Because, you know, it is a state of negation of something. But what is negated, you know, what is negated is not negated by force. It is negated, or it, you know, the object of negation of the emptiness is something non-existent naturally. It does not exist since beginning of this time. It has never been existing. So naturally, in a natural state, it doesn't exist. So therefore, this kind of nirvana, so this is not a real nirvana. This is, you know, what is known as, called as a nirvana, so-called as nirvana. It's not a nirvana, the emptiness, you know. For example, the emptiness of the table, emptiness of the person. It is not the actual nirvana, but it is called as a nirvana. It is called as the natural nirvana because it is described as a state of freedom from independent existence. And this freedom from independent existence is not something that you have to cultivate, you have to generate deliberately, but it's always there. We are always freedom, you know. We are always in the state of freedom from independent existence. So this is what is known as the natural nirvana. So natural nirvana is not the actual nirvana. Nirvana. Mean this is not a real nirvana.
Okay.
So just as, you know, someone who is called as, Sangye. For example, we have here Jambel. Jambel means Manjushri. But I don't think he's Manjushri. And Sangye. Who knows? I don't know. In the Bodhicitta. Chunyi, ultimate reality. I don't think you are ultimate reality. And Tarba, Nirvana. she is human being, not Nirvana. Nirvana is permanent. So these are the names, terms given. So similarly, emptiness is given the term non-natural Nirvana. And non-abiding Nirvana, referring to, you know, the Nirvana, the ultimate Nirvana of the Buddha. This is known as the non-abiding because this is a state which is freed of, you know, which doesn't abide in the two extremes. Extreme of, you know, samsara and the extreme of peace. And yet, peace means we should qualify that with personal peace. Which doesn't abide in the two extremes. The extreme of the pains of samsara and the extreme of the personal peace. So therefore this is referred, the nirvana that is there in in Buddha is referred to as non-abiding nirvana. And now, the more complicated or the more important thing is nirvana with residue and without residue. So, as I said earlier, the arahat who achieved arahatship at the age of 50, right? So there he achieved the arahatship, or he achieved nirvana. So that nirvana is that, you know, even after achieving nirvana, he still has to undergo pains and these things associated with his body, contaminated body. Still, he has to carry this burden of the body. So, this nirvana has a residue from the previous lives, which is this body. Before he achieved arahatship. A residue, something, you know, from a state before he achieved arahatship, he's, you know, still left with that, those residues. So therefore, that kind of nirvana is known as the nirvana with residue. So when do you think that a person will achieve a non-residual nirvana, a nirvana without residue? Next life. Oh, the person has next life. Okay, so this means at the time of death, you know, at the time of discarding this body and the karmically propelled body and the karmically propelled mind, right? So, at that point, then one is freed from this residual body, contaminated body. So then the nirvana truly becomes a nirvana, meaning that you are not just free from the afflictive thoughts, you're also free from all forms of pains, agony, and shortcomings. Now, one interesting thing is that, you may not agree with that, but this is what I mentioned to you right in the beginning. At the time of achieving the non-residual Buddha, which means that, you know, you die, just, you know, in a vernacular, in an ordinary language, we say the arahat dies, passes away. So at that point, what happens to the body? It's just totally unrelated. It's also it is either buried or cremated or put up in a stupa or whatever you do that, right? Now the question is, what about the mind? So then, Rav Bhaskar said that the mind will also disappear like rainbow disappearing in the sky at that point. Before that, it keeps on continuing the journey. And finally, when one achieves freedom from afflictions, then at the time of death, you know, at that point, just as you leave the body, the mind, it is not left behind, but it simply disappears. Nowhere. As such, there's a total discontinuation of the person. Yes.
Is that nihilism?
Sorry?
Is that nihilism?
From the point of view of a prasangika, yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So this is why Pope John Paul II says, what's the point in practicing Buddhism? You know? The whole purpose. After struggling for years and years, lives and lives, eventually, you know, your goal is to simply annihilate yourself. What's the point? You know? So you also... We are all in the same boat. We don't agree with that. So, Pope John Paul is quite right. But, as a practitioner, so we all here, I truly appreciate your genuineness, your sense of enthusiasm to practice the Dharma. It's amazing, amazing. So, from the point of view of a practitioner, this really bears a great relevance. In true sense, the person will not cease. The mind will not cease forever. It will continue forever. But as a practitioner, as a part of practicing renunciation, as a part of practicing and cultivating renunciation, you must have to have a deep sense of joy to think of, you know, oh, what if I annihilate? Oh, it'll be such a wonder. This should be what should be happening to us. Because renunciation, at that point, we see that when we are in samsara, so say, what will you think? Oh, tomorrow this pen is going to annihilate. Then you might, you know, come to look at it with kind of curiosity. You'll not say that, oh, no, it's not good, it's not bad. You'll not say that, you know. Out of curiosity, you might come to witness that. Right? If it says that, oh, tomorrow, all these trees are going to annihilate. You know? Oh, of course it's going to be so sad to see everything so barren. But still, what would it be like? So similarly, and why not this kind of feeling happening, this kind of feeling coming to you when you simply think of yourself annihilating. When you think of yourself annihilating, there's uneasiness. This indicates that how attached you are to yourself. This attachment is the very definition of samsara. So, to have a sense of renunciation, meaning sense of, you know, renouncing the world, renouncing samsara. World in the sense of samsara. So unless and until, you know, there's renouncing samsara, renouncing the, you know, desire to cut yourself from any sense of attachment to the self, there's no actual renunciation. There's no actual sense of renouncing the world, renouncing samsara. So actually, we're in samsara, you know. Say, pain, just a sore, very chronic sore. It never heals, and it's so painful. And every time you go, someone hits it. It's so painful, you know. At one point, you feel, although this is your part of your body. But you feel like you just cut this off, you know, and remove it. Right? Similarly, what is samsara? Samsara is not this world. It is associated with our thought. our thought entangled to the self, makes samsara. Right? Other than that, the Buddha appeared on this earth 2600 years ago. You know, for him, this world is not samsara. Samsara is the very definition of samsara is the mind getting entangled to the self and not wanting to release it. This is samsara. Samsara is simply created by one's own mind. Right? So just as, you know, when you see the chronic sore, which is always creating problem, you know, inconvenience to you, then at one point you simply like to cut it, the whole part, and throw it. Similarly, we see that what is samsara? What is all these pains? Is it the external thing or that? The same thing, this is so cold, you know. It makes me so cold, it makes me so unbearable, but the polar bears, they enjoy it, you know. And it is so hot, I cannot bear it, and yet the monkeys, you know, they enjoy it. So why? Some enjoy it, and I cannot bear it. So what is that? You know, just explore it. So this pain is what you dislike. And you eat just one grain of rice and you're not satisfied. Whereas a bird eats just two or three grains, that's it. So what's that? Again, there's a pain associated with that. So who is that? Why this pain? So associated with the self. So say, even if there's a car, you don't put oil in it, no fuel in it, the car simply remains not moving, and you're not bothered about it. Oh, the car, pity, the car is not, you know, having any food. You don't say that. But whereas when you don't eat something, then you feel, you know, pain, you feel so sad, you want something, you're always going after that. So, you know, there is a sense, all these sense of dissatisfaction, pain, they're nothing but something associated with something. What is that something? Not external things, it is you. So we see that it is because of this self that all these pains come about. So if there is no self, then there is no pain. If there is no self altogether, then there is no pain altogether. This is total freedom from pain. This is total freedom from samsara. So if you, through a reflection of the four seals of the Buddha's teaching, impermanence, suffering nature, and, you know, the emptiness nature, and the peace, absolute peace. If you truly reflect on that, then after knowing all these things on a more experiential level, and then when you try to reflect it upon yourself, then you see how desperate you are, and how desperate you are, not because of the external conditions, but because of the self. You know, then you would feel a very strong desire that there's no point in having the self. Why not you discard the self? If you let it go, if you simply go to let it go completely, you know, then everything that is associated with it, with this in the form of dissatisfaction, pain, shortcomings, everything will dissolve. You know, so dissolution, the evaporating of all these dissatisfactions is known as liberation. This is a total liberation. Right? So to judge whether or not you are coming up with a true sense of renunciation, see if there's a feeling of, you know, wanting to eliminate the self coming up in you. If that is coming up, then it is close towards, you know, generating a genuine renunciation. Otherwise, you know, however much you may practice all these things, but when you think about this self annihilating, if there is a sense of fear, you don't like to have it, you don't like to, you know, dissociate yourself with this person, with the self, then it is not a genuine renunciation. If that is the case, how can you expect to generate bodhicitta? Out of the three principal paths, it is first the So the, in terms of the sequence, in some cases, the wisdom comes first. In some cases, renunciation comes first. So whichever. But in terms of the renunciation and the bodhicitta, the renunciation should necessarily precede bodhicitta. So without renunciation, no bodhicitta. Right? So without bodhicitta, if you are the loser, the bodhicitta is the one which brings in all good qualities, everything good so spontaneously without an effort. And if you don't have that, if you lose that, then whatever you might have, they are all just nonsense. So, and for to have that bodhicitta, the magnet of all, which attracts all good qualities, we need to have renunciation as a precursor, right? Okay, so for that renunciation to happen, to see if that is happening in you, see what is your response to this feeling. Whether your response in the form of joy, or sense of sadness, or anxiety, or thinking, you know, annihilating the self. When there's a sense of joy coming up, then the renunciation is coming up in you in a genuine fashion. Okay. All four destroyers, we are on page 80. Page 80's second para. All four destroyers of the three vehicles have a nirvana with remainder, because they assert that when one attains a nirvana without remainder, there is a severing of the continuum of consciousness. There is annihilation. There is total ceasing of the continuum. Severing means ceasing of a continuum of consciousness, like the extinction of a flame. What will happen? There's a candle burning. There's a wonderful soothing light in the darkness. And then then the last moment of the candle part. So what will happen the next moment? Yeah, the light will go off. So this means that, then is it that the light is hidden somewhere? It's really gone. It's simply, nowhere it has gone. It has gone somewhere, but we don't know where. It's gone, So for to have a new light, for to have the light again, we need to bring a new candle. The old one, don't expect it coming back. Similarly, the mind discontinues, like a flame getting off. Without remainder, there is the severing of the continuum of consciousness, like the extinction of flame. Hence, they assert that there are three final vehicles. Okay, so there is discussion on the three final vehicles and the one final vehicle. Three final vehicles is quite simple. Say, there are three vehicles. What are they? Shravakayana, Pratika Buddha, Mayana. Three, right? So, by following the Shravakayana vehicle, you achieve the enlightenment of the Shravakas, and then the enlightenment of Pratika Buddhas, and the enlightenment of the Mahayanas, right? Three. So, if it is the case that one achieves the enlightenment of Shravakas, and then you simply remain in that state forever, without really turning to, the Mahayana, or, without really turning to achieve the other states of enlightenment, this means that it is final in its own way, it is final. And similarly, Pratika Buddha and the Mahayana, of course, the minor one is the final, no doubt, right? So, if it is the case that the other two enlightenments, whosoever achieves that, then you simply remain in that state forever, without going to, achieve some other enlightenments. This means that there are three final vehicles. Whereas, according to Prasangika Madhyamika or the higher Buddhist schools, what happens is that, some people may achieve the enlightenment of Shravakas, and others achieve Pratika Buddha's enlightenment. However, they will eventually again come down to practice the minor teachings, and finally achieve, they will not simply remain in that state, remain in those two enlightenments. These two are not the final. because they have a more, you know, they will go for something more, which is the enlightenment of the Buddha. So therefore, from the point of view of those who believe that after achieving the enlightenment of Shravakas and Pratipada Buddhas, one should necessarily have to join the Mahayana path, they mean that the final vehicle is not just one. Final vehicle is not just three. It's not three, but just one. Because finally, it is the part of the Mahayana path, which everyone has to join. Whereas according to Vaibhashikas and the lower schools, they see that it's not Buddhahood is not the only ultimate goal. You know, the other two as well are the ultimate goal. Meaning that there are some who achieve these and they will remain forever in that state. So for them, this is ultimate, right? So hence they assert that there are three final vehicles. Some propound that the teacher Buddha merely withdrew a creation of his body from the sight of certain trainees when he passed from suffering. And at Parinirvana, that is the time of the death, and did not actually pass from suffering, completely vanish. This is similar to confusion of fish and turnips. Meaning, so the explanation that is found in this passage, belief or the statement of, you know, some scholars, this is really creating confusion in the Vaibhashikas, or creating, you know, misreading in the Vaibhashikas school. So this really doesn't represent Vaibhashikas philosophy. Next, Buddha superiors have abandoned all sufferings and their origins without exception, and yet it is not contradictory that true sufferings exist within the continuum. This is what we discussed earlier. The Buddha Shakyamuni, after having achieved enlightenment, Buddhahood, right? What about his body? He achieved Buddhahood at the age of, say, 29, right? So what about the body? Is it the continuation of the body that he had before he was 29 years old?
Yes.
So this means you are exactly Vaibhashika, you know, you exactly represent Vaibhashika. Right? So let's read. Buddha superiors, referring to Buddha Shakyamuni, you know, as an illustration, have abandoned all sufferings and their origins without exception. And yet, it is not contradictory that true sufferings exist, because his body, in the form of suffering, exists within the continuum of the Buddha Shakyamuni. This is because when all afflictive emotions that take true sufferings as their objects are abandoned, this is posited as the abandonment of true sufferings. A Buddha's physical body is included in the same lifetime as the physical base of a bodhisattva on a path of preparation. Therefore, they assert that this body is not a Buddha jewel. Because this body is, you know, as you said, it's a continuation from the Bodhisattva's body, which is prone to sickness, aging, and death. So therefore, this is not Buddha. The body of the Buddha is not Buddha. This is what exactly, you know, you said. Therefore, they assert that this body is not a Buddha jewel, an object of refuge, although it is Buddha. The Buddha jewel is asserted to be the wisdom of extinction. So what is the jewel of the Buddha? What is the jewel of Buddha? It is asserted to be the wisdom of extinction, of the obscurations, and the wisdom that the obscurations will never be produced again, which exist in the mental continuum of a Buddha. You know, so here the Buddha's mental qualities, the wisdom, which first of all abandoned the obscurations or the ignorances, number one, and then number two. Number two, this wisdom has gained a confidence that these ignorances, defilements, will not relapse. So this wisdom is referred to as the jewel of the Buddha, and not his body. His body is Buddha, but it's not not the jewel of the Buddha. Right? This is the distinction that they made. Okay, what do you think? The body of the Buddha, is it absolutely pure or contaminated? Are you sure? Okay. So you truly reflect, you know, Vaibhashika. Okay, so in future, if there's any conference happening among the different schools, so I'll call you to represent Bhaskar. Then let's read ahead, let's read further. The presentation of the tenets of the proponents of the sutra is in four parts. Okay, so now with this we finished our Bhaskar. So this is what I want to make it so clear to you. The biography of the Buddha Shakyamuni is in two versions. One version according to the perception of the ordinary people as to how the biography of the Buddha is read by ordinary people, which indeed is represented by Bhaskar's presentation. And one which is, you know, extraordinary biography of the Buddha, which is only read by the higher Buddhist schools. According to, you know, so about the, you know, the reading of the biographies, the biography of the Buddha according to the ordinary people is what you really understand about the literal biography of the Buddha, you know, as to how the, as Venerable Thapa said, Father, the Buddha passed away because of food poisoning and so forth. But this is just the literal, the mere appearance, a biography of the Buddha, appearance to the ordinary beings. Whereas the actual biography of the Buddha has said that Buddha Shakyamuni achieved Buddhahood many, 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 many eons ago. You know, not just 2,600 years ago. Many, many eons, millions and billions, multiplied by billions of years ago, he achieved Buddhahood, right? Then you may wonder, then what about those 12 deeds? These are referred to as the deliberate, you know, appearance that he created to give inspirations. Inspirations to those who want to follow the path to enlightenment. Don't think of me as, you know, enlightened right from the beginning. So if you think of me, Buddha Shakyamuni, in the form of enlightened being right from the beginning, then this is the problem. Oh, he's enlightened right from the beginning. He's not, you know, the perfect example for us. Then you won't get example. So therefore, for to really put it in, to get instructions, it is best to receive instructions from someone who has really perfected the state. But in the actual event of pursuing the path, in a practical, you know, pursuit of the path, instead of the perfected being, it is better to have someone similar to you. Say, someone who is in the 10% practice, while you are in the 0%. And the Buddha Shakyamuni in the 100%, you know. So when you think of the 100%, you easily get discouraged. How can I get there? Whereas if you see, you know, 1% practitioner, oh, look, he has reached that level. Originally he was 0, and now he's 1%. Similarly, if I practice, I can also get there. You know, 1% is quite easy. And then, as you get there, then you need to have someone in the 2%, or 3%, or 10%. So that way, you can really seek the help of that person as encouragement, for encouragement and inspiration, right? Okay, so the Buddha Shakyamuni, then assuming all these 12 deeds, is simply to give us encouragement. Encouragement and to give us, you know, a real practical example as to how to follow through the path. Even if you are just, you know, a princely being, still you can achieve enlightenment. So princely being doesn't mean that, you know, whatever you have is so divine. It has some flaw. It has some, you know, mistake. Because of which, the Buddha Shakyamuni, the prince, he abandoned all those things. So therefore, if the princely possessions are to be abandoned, then what about, you know, what to mention about those things that we possess? So this means which implies that everything which belongs to samsara is to be abandoned. Don't hold to as, oh, this is princely thing, this is royal thing, this doesn't really belong to the samsara. It's not like that. Everything is of the nature of samsara. So this is why the Buddha deliberately appeared in the form of a prince, and renouncing everything, right? Which the ordinary beings feel envious of. Okay, so the purpose for the Buddha, if the Buddha is Buddha many eons ago, then why did he display it? Why did he display all these, you know, the deeds which seem to be of that of the ordinary beings, particularly the first nine activities? So this is deliberately to encourage and give inspiration, to give examples as to how to proceed along the path from the beginning ordinary level to the next, to the next, to the next, and finally to enlightenment. Okay, so there are a lot more things to, you know, speak to you about the Buddha's biography, but we have to go a little bit ahead. Okay, I think it's time up. So I will simply begin, you know, begin so that it will at least give us a good feeling that, oh, we have, you know, in Sutra Dikaya school now. Mm-hmm. Presentation of the tenets of the proponents of Sutra or Sutra Dikaya is in four parts: definition, subschools, etymology, and assertions of tenets. The same are the outlines. Okay, the definition of the Sutra Dikaya. The definition of a proponent of Sutra is a person propounding lesser vehicle tenets who asserts the true existence of both external objects and self-cognizing consciousness. Let's do the definition and then we'll stop here. So, since that you already know as to how the definitions work to categorize someone as that particular, you know, belonging to that particular school. So now let's see how successful you can do. So let's see. So last time when we were trying to define Vipassikas, we tried to cut all the other schools. And finally, by default, we tried to point to that person, or there's no other choice other than to say that he's Vipassika. So similarly, let's do it, let's try to see if the similar logic or reasoning or the similar pattern is what we can do here to define the proponent of the sutra or Sutra Dikaya. So what does it say? Let's see. A person propounding lesser vehicle. So what does this cut away? Sorry? Okay, good. The proponents or those propounding the higher vehicle tenets. Higher vehicle tenets consisting of? Chittamatra and Madhyamika. Good. One. Then who asserts the true existence of both external objects? True existence, 1 point. External objects, 2. Self-cognizing, 3. Cognizing consciousness. Who asserts true existence? What do you think it cuts?
Madhyamika.
Good. It cuts the Madhyamika. Existence of both external objects. So this means that, you know, they believe in external objects. So what this cut?
Chittamatra.
Good. And self-cognizing consciousness. They accept self-cognizing consciousness. What do you think it cuts? Vipassika. Good. Why do you think that it cuts Vipassika? Sorry? Sorry? All things exist. Vipassikas also believe that everything exists. Believes in all things existing. Then what about Sutra Dikaya? So I'm asking this question. Sutra Dikaya's believing in this self-cognizing consciousness, how does it cut it from being a Vipassika? Who? Who they? Vipassikas. Okay, good. Sutra Dikaya, if you are a believer of self-cognizing consciousness, this means that you are not Vipassika, because Vipassikas don't believe in self-cognizing consciousness. So what that philosopher should be then? Sutra Dikaya, naturally. Mm-hmm. Because we said that he is a lesser vehicle tenant holder, right? This means he is a Buddhist philosopher, right? But he is not Madhyamika because he believes in true existence. He is not Chittamatra because he believes in external reality. And he is not Vipassika because he believes in self-cognizing consciousness. So naturally it should be Sutra Dikaya. So anyone who believes in true existence and who believes in external reality and believes in self-cognizing consciousness is what is known as Sotrantika. Okay, we stop here.